This just over the news wire. The head of the Islamic State, Ibrahim, and he's a caliph, so he's a, I think he even has a PhD in Islamic studies. Ibrahim Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, whom the Iraqis, which I think is the second most disingenuous government in the world, said had been seriously injured or killed in an airstrike that they had coordinated on behalf of America. Oh boy, you got him, you got him, you got all their senior leaders. It turns out we may have killed an aide. He released a video with his voice speaking out just today. And he mentions the desperation of America and the Obaminators' commitment to increase the number of boots on the ground in Iraq by 1,500, which is something that the Obaminator announced after the airstrike that allegedly killed him. So I'm going to take it that either Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is a modern-day prophet, or he's still alive. And since I think he's still alive, we should consider what he had to say. His in his homily disparages all opponents as either being Jews, although there are no Jews engaged in the battle against the Islamic State. But, you know, if you say that your enemy is Jews, then you endear yourself with Muslims because the Quran is more anti-Semitic than is Hitler's Mein Kampf. Crusaders, which is a another name for Christians, the only difference between a Christian and a crusader in an Islamic parlance is a crusader is a Christian that is engaged fighting Muslims. That would be, of course, the United States. Apostates. Apostates is someone who is defined by the ninth sur of the Quran. They are Muslims who are either peaceful or Muslims of a different mindset as it relates to jihad, and therefore they cease to be Muslims. They become hypocrites, and according to the ninth surah, they must be killed. And devils, he says. So, his opponents are Jews, crusaders, apostates, and devils. And he says the U.S. and its allies are terrified, weak, and powerless. The recording calls for attacks in Saudi Arabia. Now, I don't think the Islamic State is going to invade Saudi Arabia. I think they may someday invade Jordan, although the clearest path to Jordan is really, you know, through the Damascus area, and they really have no chance of taking over Damascus, not in any time soon anyway. And he said that Saudi Arabia and its leaders were the head of the snake. Now, it's true that Saudi Arabia originally supplied the weapons for the Islamic State, and the Islamic State got out of control. You know, they built this tool to bludgeon their foes, which are Shia Muslims, particularly empowered Shia Muslims, therefore the Iranians, and they wanted to by their own admission, diminish the influence of Iran following the American invasion of Iraq. And so they provided the weapons that that enabled the Islamic State and al-Nusra initially against Assad. But the monster that they were creating got out of hand. Got out of control. And it was obvious that that monster was not going to respect the hand that was feeding it and was soon going to bite it off. And so the Saudi Arabians have besmirched the Islamic State. And so the Islamic State says, oh, the hell with you. I don't need any more weapons. You got nothing I need. I don't need your money. I don't need your weapons. And you're speaking ill of us. The hell with you. So they're calling now the very nation that created the Islamic State, the head of the snake. And it says that U.S.-led military campaign in Syria and Iraq is failing. That would be true. The Gulf state rulers who have joined the U.S.-led coalition against the Islamic State are described as being treacherous. So there you have it. And by the way, there are other mentions here in this video. It says that all of the rumors that have swirled around the status of the Islamic State's elusive leader have now been answered. He's very much alive. And within hours of the video, the audio message, too, that we now know that he has promised an expansion of the Islamic State's campaign into new countries. It calls for attacks on the land of the two holy mosques, which would be Saudi Arabia, listing Shia Muslims as the top target, which would be Iran and Western Iraq, which is essentially Iran today. So he wants attacks on Saudi Arabia and Iran, but he did not say that he would invade either. And folks, I just don't see it. I mean, would he love to be able to invade in Iran and Saudi Arabia? Absolutely. Is it true that Muslims have an overinflated sense of their own power and capability? Absolutely. I mean, they're delusional in this regard. So could they do it because they're because he's delusional? Yeah, but should there be, and since you can only gauge people based upon them doing what is rational, as opposed to trying to determine that which is irrational. If it's irrational, then it's way beyond my capacity to tell you what's going to happen. I don't live in that world. You know, there's no way to have a rational discussion about irrational behavior. But if Baghdadi is rational, and thus far he has been rational, then he's not invading Saudi Arabia, and he's not invading Iran. Because while Saudi Arabia is Sunni, and he would find significant support in Saudi Arabia, the fact is the military is way too significant. And in Iran, there's just no chance that he could prevail. And I think he knows it. The other things that were mentioned, it's there's the new oaths of alliance from jihadists in Egypt and in Algeria as well in Libya. Are all noted. The American press only presented the oaths of allegiance with the Islamic State in Egypt and the Sinai. I reported on that last week. But there have also been oaths of allegiance in Algeria, as well as Libya, which is Grand Central for weapons for Muslim terrorists worldwide. It mocks the announcement of the 1,500 additional U.S. military advisors in Iraq, saying the U.S. airstrikes had failed to stop the advance of the Islamic State. In fact, the airstrikes have done exactly what the military terms. They claim that it has driven the Islamic State fighters off of key dams. There's, by the way, no indication that that was the case. The reality is that this myth that the Islamic State was somehow going to blow up a dam above Mosul because they're a terrorist organization, no. Mosul is their power base. So they're there because of the Sunni Muslims that are there. They don't want to kill the Sunni Muslims. That's their base. And blowing up the dam would eliminate the source of power and eliminate the people. It's just a total and complete myth that's being reported. He went on to say in his homily, to use a good Catholic religious term, "O soldiers of the Islamic State, erupt volcanoes of jihad everywhere. light the earth with fire against all dictators. Now, he's a dictator, by the way. Allah has ordered us to fight. For that reason, the soldiers of the Islamic State are fighting. They will never leave fighting. Even if only one soldier remains, they will never leave fighting because they reject humiliation. You see, in Islam, everything is humiliating. Allah is modeled after Satan. Man is humiliated. In fact, that's the whole purpose of Islam, is to degrade man, is to humiliate mankind, because that's what Satan wants to do. Satan's initial rebellion occurred because God was paying mankind more attention than the Moloch. And Satan says, you're going to be so fascinated with mankind, if that's your new favorite thing, then the hell with you. And so his impetus, his raison d'etre during the time that he's released is to degrade man, to destroy the reason that God was spending time with us. I mean, that's his whole motivation, is to degrade. And so Islam, being a satanic religion, humiliates and degrades humankind, particularly women, of course. And so Muslims are degraded. They're humiliated. And when you compare an Islamic country to an Islamic, non-Islamic country, there's even greater humiliation. So since a Muslim can't blame their religion on their own degenerate nature, they blame everybody else. They blame the Jews. They blame the Crusaders. They blame everyone except their religion, when their religion is solely to blame. And so they lash out because they're humiliated, not knowing that their humiliation is caused by Islam. And it is true that Allah ordered Muslims to fight for all time against all people until the only religion in the world was Islam. That's what the Quran orders Muslims to do. He is citing Allah's orders accurately. Baghdadi himself, they say, is a shadowy figure. He's not. He's an Islamic cleric who only showed himself publicly for the first time in a video released in July, delivering a sermon in Mosul. He claims lineage from a family and tribe of the Prophet Muhammad. Yeah, right. Not true. The conclusion of Baghdadi's speech was exactly as I had anticipated. He said that the Islamic State itself had promised to break the borders of Jordan and Lebanon and to free Palestine. Well, I do not think that the Islamic State is going to invade Shiite Iran or even try to occupy the Shiite areas, including Baghdad in Iraq. And I do not see that the Islamic State is likely to try to invade and occupy the land of two mosques, which would be Saudi Arabia, because it would be at too great a cost. I do think that they are convinced that they could prevail in Jordan. That if they start promoting this idea that Israel should not exist and that it really is Palestine, and that they are willing to equip the Muslims living in refugee camps in Jordan, who are treated like dirt by the Jordanian monarchy, they would find that probably three-quarters of the Jordanians would fight with them against the monarchy. And so I've always thought that Jordan would be an easy win for the Islamic State. Now, I think that Lebanon is a tougher win unless you're dealing with southern Lebanon for the express purpose of using it as a means to attack Israel. And if they threaten to attack Israel, it'll make the Islamic State infinitely more powerful, more popular with the world's Sunni Muslims. So they are, in fact, thinking about, hoping to, maybe even planning, and they're certainly promising to invade Jordan and Lebanon to liberate what they consider to be Palestine. Well, right now, they've erased the border between Iraq and Syria, and they're talking about erasing them between Jordan, Lebanon, and Israel. It's exactly what you would have expected from them. Hello, Glenn. How are you?
Hello, Yada. I'm doing okay.
Good.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I keep thinking, you know, one of the worst things you can do is to underestimate people, especially someone you're planning on making an enemy or manipulating or playing for a fool. And it just seems to me that the West, and especially the U.S., has vastly underestimated, you know, the Islamic State, the Muslim world in general. And, you know, all of their attempts, I mean, it seems like it's the U.S. that ends up twisting in the wind when they try to manipulate these various Muslim entities.
And yeah, we have certainly done that with the Islamic State. We have, well, there's no question we've done that with the Islamic State. We've done that with Iran, too. You know, America thinks that they can browbeat Iran, that the threat of,
yes,
of sanctions will browbeat Iran into submission. The same miscalculation has been used recently against Russia, that we could browbeat Russia into submission and to do our to acquiesce to our demands if we impose sanctions. Well, all that did is it put Iran and Russia together in a massive nuclear deal that completely thwarted the United States' ambitions. So we underestimated the two, and we pushed them into a scenario that was the opposite of what we were trying to achieve. Now, the same thing is true to a degree with the Islamic State. The Islamic State is a much more formidable foe than we want to acknowledge. There's not 20 or 30,000 members, as we claim, but hundreds of thousands. And they are strong because of the awakening program that America created a monster and then now wants to rein in that monster, kind of like Saudi Arabia. But when you have religious zealots who not only are willing but desirous of dying for their cause, that are equipped with the best American weapons, they're formidable. I mean, are they going to achieve anything? No. But are they going to destroy things? Absolutely. I mean, yeah, there's no way to wipe them out. It can't be done.
Oh, they created a monster, and I just need Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Everybody in the State Department ought to read Frankenstein and get the clue.
Yeah, yeah. We made this monster. We made this monster because they were the enemy of our enemy. We chose to have Assad to be our enemy, and the Islamic State was the enemy of our enemy. So we befriended them. We equipped them. We empowered them. We made this monster. And now the monster is on the loose. Welcome back to Saturday, Mr. Having a conversation with Glenn about the United States having a tendency to underestimate their foes. You know, that strategy, or lack thereof, can get you in particular trouble when you're actually arming your adversary to make them a more formidable foe.
Exactly. And these sociopathic sophomores, these educated fools at Rand and Brookings and Tavistock, are so committed to manipulation, subversion, and deception. I mean, they would rather find ways to lie and manipulate people to maintain their illusions of control than just deal with something, you know, look at something more at face value, forthrightly, like you're saying. If we do this, we're only going to strengthen them. But no, they have to, they're compelled to follow through and manipulate and do everything, you know, proxy puppeteer. They are committed to being manipulative puppeteers. And it's going to blow up in their face.
You know, what's interesting is the American think tanks were exposed in an article published by the New York Times about 2 months ago, where the New York Times found that the think tanks publish opinions based upon who gives them the most money. And the dominant source of money for the Washington-based American think tanks is Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. What they're getting is the view of the Saudi Arabians and Sunni Muslim dictators, because that's who paying them. And it's not a small potatoes here. I mean, you'd have European governments that might, you know, like Sweden, that might provide $100,000 per think tank. And the Belgians, the Norwegians, and the like might provide $50,000 per think tank. But the Qataris, $10 million. The Saudis, $15 million. You know, it's the dominant influence on them.
Yeah, we paid J.D. Powers to do an objective study to find out how great our car is. Well, gee, I wonder how that study's going to turn out, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Essentially what you're doing is you're paying huge amounts of money to pay somebody to lie to you so you can have wrong ideas in your head.
Well, you know, if you look at politics and the fact that everyone on the President's National Security Council and everyone in his cabinet was chosen by him, and they're all exquisitely paid. They're all have jobs that pay hundreds of thousands of dollars, plus cars, plus housing allowances, plus world-class benefits. And they have access to everything that the power of being a high-ranking government official provides in Washington, D.C. Now, when you realize what they're paid and how they got that job, what do you think the likelihood is that if the president disassociates the Islamic State from Islam, that they're going to make the association and say, that's your problem?
Right. And what you end up with is, oh, Mr. Emperor, sir, your clothes are so wonderful. Your new clothes are
absolutely
every
it's
time.
Like this guy that says, hey, we're not having a disagreement. We're not trying to come up with a new plan. We're just simply recognizing that you always have to evaluate everything that you're doing, and we're just tweaking and evaluating our strategy as it relates to eliminating the Islamic State. No, you're not.
Right.
You declared war and you didn't have a plan, and you've made a bad situation worse, and you have no clue whatsoever how to fix this problem because everybody that you're talking to is afraid to tell you the truth because they'll lose their job if they were to.
It's just like professors kowtowing for grant money and having publishing personal. It doesn't matter what human devil. We're talking cars, academics, or this stuff. You know, humans wimp out and they kowtow to money and tell people what they want to hear. And it's just a fundamental human dynamic. The one thing I know about the Islamic situation is, I know from Ezekiel that at some point you talk about Islamic State threatening Israel. Well,
right.
I know because of Ezekiel 38 that at some point down the line, Persia, Iran, which is presently adverse to them, it has to be incorporated into this huge force that before they go against Israel. And politically, that's not just in place. So you hear all this, the Shiites are subsumed and recruited or combined somehow, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, Glenn, I haven't translated Ezekiel 38 yet. I just completed a review, a read-through of all prophecy. Read every prophetic book end-to-end and in succession, including the Ezekiel passages that you're mentioning. And, of course, the names used for the nations from which the Muslims are going to emerge to declare war on Israel are permeate all the prophecies, because this war against Israel, which precedes Yahweh's return, is a big deal. You know, Yahweh's testimony is only on those things that influence Israel. He could care less what the rest of the world is doing. He doesn't care that the United States and Russia and China are not getting along. It's of no interest to him. The only thing that's of interest to him is that which favorably or adversely affects Israel. So the reason that the Magog War and the Islamic nations that will participate in the Magog War are mentioned because they adversely affect Israel. Now, I was not convinced my last time through the material that you have to have a combined Iraq-Iran. I do think it's likely, but and what I saw happening really was that if there is a combined Iraq-Iran, it's the Iraq-Iran that exists for the most part now, which is all Iran, and that they will play a role in the attack, and that Syria is really the Islamic State. And that Syria and Jordan will kind of all be merged into the Islamic State. Now, it is true that Shia Muslims are willing to fight alongside Sunni Muslims so long as they're killing Jews. But I'm not positive you have to have both sides of the Tigris and Euphrates to facilitate the Magog War. I think you get...
But in terms of just in terms of the fact that the Persians were a different people, they're not even Arabs. Forgetting about the modern nation of Iran, Persia as a people is clearly unambiguously identifiable. So at some point the Persian influence has to be part of that. Egypt is notably absent. Libya is mentioned. Syria is not. So there's got to be some sort of... what I'm saying is, we know we've had 12 years. This isn't going to happen overnight. I remember saying before, months ago, I remember saying this proxy war foolishness is going to go on for quite some time.
Yeah, it is. When you looked at some of the developments that were taking place in the Islamic world, it did not look... particularly when Barack Hussein Obama, about a year ago, was negotiating with the world to put Israel in a situation where it had to relinquish the West Bank or be completely ostracized from the entire world. When you looked at that scenario, and that would have split Israel in two, a narrowed her at the waist, that would have fulfilled the Yeshaya 17 prophecy, but it would have done so 12 years early.
Right,
And had it not been for Hamas shooting rockets into Israel, and had it not been for the development of the Islamic State, America would still be on the warpath to force Israel to capitulate in this regard. So things that we did not see ended up...
Right.
Delaying the inevitable so that the inevitable fits the timeline. And as it turns out, the timeline, the time frame, did include the destruction of Syria and of Damascus, which is where the principal delaying mechanism is taking place right now. The United States is too distracted with what's happening in Syria, greater Syria, if you will, which would be Syria and Iraq, to be forcing Israel to capitulate. And that's exactly what Yeshaya 17 told us was going to happen. So, we were given all the information. It's just sometimes we don't see it until it happens. And you say, that's exactly what was predicted.
Well, I know you have, I remember you've spoken about the Damascus thing several times.
Yeah.
It does seem to me like at some point that I still kind of hold to the notion that we're at some point talking about a cataclysmic, destruction of Damascus, and that would be future. I mean, something like that for the time being, we're still in a phase where we're paid to expect the unexpected, because things are going to happen according to Yahweh's predicted time frame.
Right. And when you hear about the destruction of Damascus, and it's a tumbled heap of ruins. Damascus is going to end up looking like Homs and Aleppo. I mean, Homs and Aleppo in northwestern Syria are presently exactly as Damascus is described in the prophecy that serves as the catalyst for the severing of Israel and then the Magog war, Muslims against Israel. And since it's all happens really in succession, I would expect Damascus to fall and become a heap of ruins until we move closer to the beginning of the tribulation, which is, as you say, it's 12 years off. So what's interesting is that the United States, which is the belligerent that Yahweh is so opposed to in the 18th chapter of Yeshayah, is the very country right now that is working to forestall the destruction of Damascus. Now, the destruction of Damascus is inevitable. You and I know it. But it's being forestalled because it's not inevitable now. It's inevitable, you know, 10 to 12 years from now.
And these geniuses eventually displace the Assad regime and IS takes over, you know, that, and becomes exceedingly militant towards Israel. Well, there you go.
There you go.
That's just one possibility.
What Baghdadi just said is exactly as we would expect the entree to this Magog war to be. It's what he just said is exactly what Yahweh predicted in Yeshayah. So it is moving apace, but the pace is still 10 to 12 years off. We're talking with Glenn about the Magog war, and we're using a date that most of our listeners are familiar with, 12 years out. That would be the fall of 2026. And the reason we're using that date is because it is apparent, really obvious, that Yosef fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavua in 33 CE, and that was year 4000 on Yahweh's calendar. And you can go back 1,000 years from there, and you have 968 BCE is when Dod laid the foundation for the first temple. And you can go 1,000 years before that, and it's when Abraham fulfilled the covenant on Mount Moriah, the same place that temple was built, the same place that Yahusha fulfilled Pesach in 1968 BCE. And so there is a timeline that is that's clearly developed by Yahweh, where the single most important year 4000 Yah, the fourth day of creation, the greater light became visible and fulfilled these promises. And since Yahweh tells us that everything he does is based on 6 plus 1, if you take 2,000 years from year 4,000 Yah, you get to year 6,000 Yah, it's not hard to add 2,000 years to 33 CE. You get 2033, and that's when he's going to fulfill Yom Kippurim and Sukkah. Now, and so now you know the date that he's going to return, because he's going to return on the Day of Reconciliations on Yom Kippurim, and that he's going to establish the millennial Shabbat on the celebration of the Shabbat, which is Sukkah. Yeah, I mean, not hard. This is not hard to figure out.
He's the stone from heaven who smashes the feet of iron and clay of the statue in Daniel.
And, that is correct.
And I'd like to take a minute to refute something that really starting to get on my nerves in talk radio.
Please.
And
then
I variously hear these various talk show hosts veering off of two different extremes. One is the extreme apocalypticism of a potential humans could cause an extinction level event.
No, they can't.
Yahweh has ordained otherwise. And on the other hand, they veer off on the other extreme, speaking about some glorious go into the stars, new age of highly actualized humanity. That's not going to happen either, because humans are sinners. We're under God's judgment, and we need to be in covenant with Yahweh and redeemed by Him.
Let's deal with the first one, and then I want you to restate the second one. The first one, that man can create a cataclysmic event. Now, here's where I would disagree slightly with you, Glenn, and it's only slightly. And I think you're going to agree with my slight departure. Man could create one. We have the capacity to destroy all life. And Yahweh tells us in his prophecy that the timing of his return is to forestall mankind obliterating the planet and all life on the planet.
It should be shortened. Right.
Exactly. So we can do it. We're going to try to do it. It's that Yahweh is not going to allow us to do it. Therefore, to prepare for it is foolish. I think that's the point you were trying to make. I think we actually agree on all of that, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, okay. So there is no reason to prepare for a doomsday event because God's going to preclude it. Man's going to try to create it. Man can create it, but God's going to forestall it. So there's no reason to prepare for a doomsday event. In fact, the smart thing to do.
The population will reduce by half because one quarter of the population will be killed, and then the one third of the remainder, which is the same size as the first quarter, leaving approximately half of the original population.
Will be killed. Just in major calamity events. Those are events, though, that I think take place during the midpoint of that tribulation. I think from there it gets worse. So while there's going to be a terrible period on Earth, the smart thing to do is rather than prepare for a doomsday event, is to join the Exodus that's going to be leaving the planet as part of the covenant is the best advice.
The goal is to be part of Yahweh's remnant.
Right.
Yahweh is not saving the world. He's saving his remnant.
That is correct. Yeah, he has no interest in saving the world.
Right.
Now, the second point that you made, now we may not get all of this in before we move into the next hour, but I don't, in fact, we don't. If you can stay with us, we'll begin the third hour with your second point, because I'm not sure I understood it. Want to understand it and then discuss it with you as we did here your first point, which, as it turns out, we agree right down to the smallest details that there's no reason to prepare for a doomsday event.